This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome. I've got a great science interview for you in the second half of this program. Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program, will tell us how unpredictable our future has become. But first, this surprise guest. The term deep state used to be kept carefully out of bounds for the mainstream media. Now, with the machinations of the Trump regime, the leaks, and the Russians, the deep state is part of open talk. But what is it? Robin Upton has been documenting the deep state for a long time. Robin is a mathematician by training. He's a radio podcast host and a researcher's researcher. He was raised in the United Kingdom and Denmark, but since 1998, Robin Upton has picked a new home, Bangladesh. We've connected by a maybe questionable cell phone line, so let's get right to it. Robin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be on the air. I've been a listener of yours for several years, and I know that Lynn Gary, who started the podcast that I do, Unwelcome Guests, regularly used to host your materials, so I'm chuffed to be here.
Yeah, it's great to get together because I think we've got some things in common and some things different. Well, let's get to it. For those who don't know, what is the deep state?
Well, it depends who you're asking. The research that you mentioned in the intro is an encyclopedia that I thought I'd been helping with. I found that while I was researching material for Unwelcome Guests, and I found basically a wiki, which, I mean, you know what a wiki is. It depends on what the who's put the content in. But I thought, because of the what was there, and I thought there's real potential here to actually document what's going on, what, at least from what I thought I had to help people understand, and to bring in the deep state. I'm going to define that as a loosely, I mean, it's not a unified command. There's pretty little in terms of paperwork on this. You don't get appointed to it. You don't have positions in it. It's not like the public power structures, but it is something like a power structure. It's a loosely affiliated group of sometimes competing, sometimes cooperating people that I call deep politicians, for want of a better name. But the image is, we know what a puppet leader is, and my suggestion is that a lot of the so-called top leaders of the nation states, or maybe even of multinationals, of these, they're the front men, but they're not actually making the decisions. So where do the decisions get made? A range of different places. We got another term that we use on WikiSpooks, deep state milieu. I've got to give credit before I talk any more about the deep state to Peter Dale Scott. He's a former diplomat, professor of English. He's Canadian born, but he did a lot of work to publicize when he coined the term, and it is remarkable how that term has just popped up in corporate media sources. I don't call them mainstream because I consider them to be pretty extremist in their views. I mean, maybe a lot of them, and they have apparently, you know, different titles, but we know about media consolidation. So I think that the thesis that behind the scenes, a lot of these nominally independent organizations are actually well coordinated. I don't think that's going to raise too many eyebrows. So it's a group of people who organize, use these front men, some of them, you know, national leaders, people, you know, talking about Obama, how much power does he have? I don't think you can get to be president without oiling a few palms, so to speak. So the deep state is the label that we use to describe these processes. Now, that may differ from how the deep state is described on CNN or other such sources. I mean, it would be surprising if it didn't, because there's a lot of evidence that the deep state actually more or less controls this fourth estate, the media. So, you know, the question of why is the deep state suddenly being talked about now is certainly an interesting one. But, at the outset, let's be clear that different people use that phrase deep state to mean different things.
Right. Okay. Now, The storyline on sites like Zero Hedge is that Donald Trump is an outsider being thwarted at every turn by an established power structure beyond conventional party politics. It sounds like you agree with that.
I'm not expecting a lot from the Trump presidency. I mean, I fundamentally at heart, Alex, I am an optimist, but don't misunderstand me. If Trump has an accident and is found dead or disabled somehow, well, then I think that's pretty strong evidence that he was a threat to the establishment. If that doesn't happen, I'm not actually expecting that. There's a lot of ways of exerting influence over people. I mean, I don't know a great deal about Trump's shady past, but I do believe that it's pretty difficult to accumulate that amount of wealth without transgressing and without incurring a few debts, so to speak, to established figures. So I think it's a lot more plausible. I would not be disappointed at all to be proved wrong on this, but I think it is quite plausible that Trump is there because somebody had to be there, and people are generally wising up to the charade of democracy. So having had somebody whom possibly dark-skinned Americans thought was going to be a breath of fresh air, and, you know, it promised things like, let's shut down Guantanamo, so Obama was nominally a change, remember that change that we could believe in that got talked about a lot before the election and didn't actually materialize. I think Trump might be a replay, but appealing this time for people who are disillusioned with the standard party politics. So he have to capitalize on that, present himself as a kind of maverick figure and say, well, yeah, I'm going to really change things this time. So it'd be great if a lot of positive change does materialize, but looking at the team of people that he's assembled doesn't give me great hope for the future.
Well, before we go deeper, Robin, I have to ask, why did you choose Bangladesh as your home?
The answer to this question keeps changing, but it maybe chose me. I grew up in Northern Europe, and one seminal experience for me as a kid, I saw Live Aid, and I saw huge numbers of desperately hungry Africans, and I was really shocked because, you know, there they were on the living room TV, and I'd never seen anything like it, and I was just appalled. And that was the first time it happened, and, you know, the message is, okay, we got to give these guys some food, so that means money, so you got to pay some money, and then the problem will go away. And, yeah, appalled at their plight and inspired by people one or two people, you know, the tabloid media sold the house and gave all the money to Oxfam. But then I was more deeply appalled when the same thing more or less happened. It kept happening. You know, it kept being these famines. And I thought, well, if humanity can put a man on the moon, how hard is it going to be to move food where we've obviously got plenty of it from one country to another country where we haven't got plenty of it? Well, that pointed out to me that actually feeding the hungry, well, people will rattle tins, but it didn't appear to be a high priority. And then I thought that's really appalling. And I don't want to grow up to be somebody who says, oh, isn't it terrible? I'll give them £10 and what's for lunch? Who's going to win the game, do you think? You know, I just thought that's so much more important than a lot of the sort of cultural sideshows that people tend to spend a lot of time on, that I wanted to actually do something about it. So I had that awareness that living in the so-called developed countries, I was not experiencing reality in the way that the majority of people in the world do. So lacking that knowledge, it's an act of great faith to say, well, I'm going to give some money to some people that I've never really checked out, and I'm going to pray that somehow makes a difference. So if that's not enough, I mean, we know about corruption, that's a given. So I'm going to go and see what's actually happening. And I thought, well, you know, I got a privilege here. I got a university education. I get a grant. I get some training. And then I'm going to go myself and that money isn't going to go missing if it's me there face to face. So that inspired me to try and find a way out of. A metaphor I've used is the Truman Show, where he's living this life and is somehow alerted that actually there's another world outside. So that was really what inspired me to try it. And then it was just a personal connection came up. And I was like, oh, well, we need somebody to teach computers in an orphanage in Bangladesh. I said, well, I know a bit about computers. They probably don't know much in Bangladesh. They've probably never seen the things before. So that got me started. And Bangladesh has a terrible image abroad. You know, when I say I've come back from Bangladesh, first thing that people do is say, yeah, how's India? And I go, I'll explain, no, this is Bangladesh, that's a little bit different. And then the next response tends to be, are you getting enough to eat? How's your house? Did you get flooded? So that's a side effect of the way that Bangladesh is portrayed by organizations which capitalize on the plight of a few people. But I mean, the truth about Bangladesh is that we've got more than 1,000 people per square kilometer living here, for the most part, quite successfully, quite happily. And, you know, it's a different world in that sense. People have a very different attitude to sort of personal space. From a Western perspective, it's incredibly crowded. But I realized I wanted a contrast. I mean, I wasn't particularly enamored of a lot of the goals of, you know, Western materialism. And I found something here, kind of a wholesomeness. The fact that most people, even now, most people actually eat by growing food themselves, living off the land, and more or less, even when people are living in the city, people have got a village home. So that process, which rounded up people and put them in cities in England centuries ago, the enclosure, that's still really ongoing. People are very connected to the land, very connected to other people. I didn't quite know what I was, you know, the glitch in the matrix. I didn't quite know what I was missing until I came here and I started to see it. I didn't say, well, I'm moving to Bangladesh. I just thought, you know, I'll follow where the wind takes me. And without really intending to, I found myself getting quite at home here.
I think I know what you're talking about. I was in India quite a while ago, but for a few months, and one of the shocking things that I saw there was how happy the average person seemed to be compared to a Canadian. The stress levels were much lower. People smiled. They laughed openly on the streets. So we do have a distorted picture of what's happening overseas, I think.
It goes both ways. I sat in a cafe, and I was surrounded by idyllic pictures of sort of foreign icons. You know, it was Tower Bridge over here and somewhere else there was like this beautiful pine forest. But it was very clearly not Bangladesh. I'm speaking about Dhaka more than the people in the village. But a lot of people seem to think that outside of Bangladesh, which is actually, it is really difficult for a Bangladeshi to get a visa to get out of Bangladesh. So that's a factor of how the politics and the economics work. But it's also true that the economic system means that the few people who get out, if they put in a few years of hard work, when they move the money back to Bangladesh, then they're fabulous. So it's quite easy to understand, I think, why a lot of people in Dhaka are thinking, yeah, Bidesh, that's abroad, that's an upgrade from living in Dhaka. And I have to point out to people that it's not like you see on the television. I mean, yes, the physical world, that's the easiest part to understand. That people here have, you know, they're generally pretty relaxed, and the support that you get from the people that you grew up with, because everybody shares your home village. You don't move your home village. When people ask me, you know, where's my home village, I got to explain, well, I was born in some random hospital somewhere in a city where my parents happened to be working at the time, and then I moved, and then I moved, and I have to explain that basically I haven't really got a home village in their sense, and that gives people a new perspective. I can understand how difficult it is for Westerners, to sort of people who've never experienced that, to grasp the support that you get, the feeling of security. If you're alone and cut adrift in the city, well, then money is the lifeline, that nothing is going to happen without money. That's a fact of life for people in the so-called developed world, which for a lot of people here, it doesn't work that way.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. My guest is alternative radio host and deep state researcher Robin Upton. Right about now, Robin, the media is trying to sell us on the idea that Russia is already at war with the United States, just a covert war by other means. You have said, I believe, in the past that the whole world is engaged in a kind of civil war. What do you mean?
Well, yesterday I was musing on our society, how hard it is to really show compassion. You know, if you've got a job in an institution, the chances are you've got a job description, you've got job guidelines. I mean, in the extreme case, say you're processing forms that people have filled in. A lot of these jobs are done by computer, and that's interesting in itself, that Western society has a lot of functionaries whose jobs could be given over to computer. It doesn't say much for our human capabilities that are exercised in that power system. So I said the whole world is a war in the sense of people are fighting about money. How long? I mean, this one is quite in Dhaka City. We don't have a lot of price tags on things in shops. And if you get on a bus, you don't buy a ticket. That gets negotiated. And, yeah, there's going rates for things, but you've got to know them. But the upshot is that there's a lot of time is spent arguing about prices. And what is a price? I mean, it's a notional thing. And I got this sort of semi-outsider's view, because if you live off the land and you grow your own food, well, then you've got to be very attentive to the difference between a healthy plant and a dying plant, and food that's rotten and food that's good to eat. But you don't have a notion of prices. And this is what I mean about the ongoing civil war. Why would so many people in Africa be hungry? Is it because English people don't care about other people? Well, I don't accept that. I think that people on one level do care. And if their activities, if their day-to-day operations and the decisions that they make don't reflect that by, say, getting to the bottom of the problem, let's plant some healthy food crops here, let's try and mitigate the effects of climate change, let's actually get onto this and try and do the best that we can for these people, which would be, I think, a healthy human approach. I'm not talking, I mean, there may be about 1% of humanity psychopaths who don't have a conscience, and for them, well, the world is maybe composed of competing individuals who are all trying to get the most for themselves and never mind anybody else. But the vast majority of humanity isn't like that. Maybe 99% of people actually have a conscience, and they know what it is to suffer, and they look and they can see in somebody's face, well, I don't want to treat somebody badly. So how does this end up in famine? How does it end up in wars? There's this story which is spun about the importance of the economy. We've got to keep the economy growing. What's the economy? The economy isn't going to feed us. We've got to cut down the rainforest to feed the economy. It makes some kind of sense. It's internally consistent, this idea about money and economy, but it doesn't seem to me to respect the real world. I mean, you know, we know that we need species diversity. We know that we don't want to replace the whole jungle with a tract of oil palms, and yet it happens and makes money. Or people get phrase making money. I mean, it's not making something in the sense of creating it. Well, okay, there's central banks who create money out of thin air. That should help us to see that it's ultimately just a fiction. And then there's businessmen who make money by taking it off somebody else. You know, we're not talking about forgers here. That would be one thing that we could talk about. This is the real making of money. You start with no money, and then there's money. Well, that's not what we call making money. It's a long process. There's a lot of ideas connected here, and they're fairly fundamental, I think, to the sort of modern Western capitalism. I think it was Derek Dennison who says it's the unspoken assumptions of a society that really define it. You know, we're discussing something, should we do this or should we do that? Well, that's not on a deeper level, because the alternatives, if we say, well, we've got a lot of options here, but of course everybody has to make money to survive, well, then we've already framed it in a way that is ultimately, it's not changing the hegemony of these central banks. I mean, that's just one set of institutions. You know, it's a whole kind of military-industrial complex. You can boost the economy by making bombs or laser-guided whatever. Well, then we're boosting the economy, and we can't take jobs away from people. But isn't it terrible how these terrorists kill people? I think, I mean, I've been living here for years, and I go back to the UK every so often, and I do keep in touch with the things with independent media. That helps me to try and hold both perspectives in my mind. But I haven't heard a lot of people questioning the fundamentals. This seems to be the defining institution of our time, more even than the religion. And to look at the longevity of this idea, that there is a thing called money, and we have to somehow fit our lives and our plans around money rather than the reverse.
You've thought this through, Robin Upton, to the point of constructing a possible alternative economic system. What is friend-to-friend, for example?
I mean, we know what P2P is. That's associated with file sharing. I did, in about 2003, work on a new economic system. This goes back to my dissatisfaction with the modern economic system. That was called economic science when it was brought in. But, I mean, I think that's a very deceitful name, so I'm glad it's just become economics. Because the modern science, as I understand it, is an attempt to understand the world. So we're going to explore what is out there and try and model it and map it and predict it. But economic science seems to me to not be doing that. I lost interest in economics, normal economics, in my first lecture at university, when the lecturer, you know, given his credit, was going through the introduction and said, are we happy to assume that there's only two goods available in the world? Because we know there's a lot of goods, but we want to graph these, and we're going to use a paper, so let's give it an X and a Y axis. And because if we can model two, we could assume that the same kind of principles are going to hold for lots of goods. Well, I thought, yeah, fair enough, that's quite neat. I like it, X and Y. Next assumption, we're going to assume that everybody is a selfish maximizer, so they just want the most for themselves, and they're not bothered about what happens to other people. Are we happy to assume that? This was a rhetorical question that you asked the first years in economics, and so I don't think he was expecting me to raise my hand and say, well, I know that that's not true, because there are people in this world that I really care about, and I don't want more for myself if that's going to mean that my friends don't have enough or if they get less. So this, he was temporarily nonplussed, and you know, the best he could come up with is, well, we have to assume this, otherwise we can't do economics. So since economics was a compulsory part of my course and I wanted to pass my course, then I did knuckle down and I passed that economics course. But that was where my real interest finished, because, I mean, you know how logic works. If A implies B, but A is not true, well, that doesn't tell us anything. If you start with an incorrect assumption, nothing that you build on top of that is going to be of particular merit. So I reinterpreted economics slowly as not a system to explore and explain the real world, but a kind of post hoc justification for why things are the way they are. And if people happen to misunderstand it, an explanation of the real world, well, more fool then. But as we conceived economic literacy, that doesn't have a terrible, I would put that phrase in quotes, literacy, teaching people to read, that's opening a world to them where they can go and explore and do what they like. But economic literacy is about telling people this is how the world is and everybody is selfish, and if you don't believe that, well, you're not economically literate, so you can't get promoted to the next stage on your business qualifications. So, that this is a huge introduction to your question about an alternative economic system. But that was my experience of ordinary economics. And then left to my own devices, I thought there's a lot of what happens in society is sort of built upon this premise of competing individuals, which we know from our own personal lives, that's not how people actually are. So what would happen if we didn't have that assumption? Could we do anything like sort of economics? Could we build a model which doesn't take that as a given? And at the time, I was looking after my granny who had Alzheimer's, so I would occasionally get a phone call. I can detect its phone spam. It was a scammer. And then I thought, you know, why not betray my grandmother? She's got Alzheimer's. There's no way she doesn't have a memory. So I could get rich at my granny's expense. I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. She's my granny. But if I can earn $200 in a way that only costs her $100, well, then I'll do it. I can make it good. So instead of becoming a selfish maximizer, I was a maximizer for myself and somebody else. Now that, if we have to be maximizers of any kind, and I think, you know, certainly in terms of calorie intake, that humans are satisficers rather than maximizers. We'd like to get enough. If we don't have enough, we're really in trouble. But do we necessarily want, do we have unlimited demands? I don't think we do. I think that's part of the sort of modern economics canon. But that was where it started. I thought, could we make a system which doesn't assume that everybody's selfish? And so that was what I called altruistic economics, and people thought it was interesting. I spoke to various people about it. It got a little bit of reportage at the time. Ultimately, I'm not sure there was a good name for it, because there seemed to be two groups of people. There was people who hadn't much of an economics background, and they would look at it, altruistic economics. That was a turn off already, because they said, well, I don't know about economics. And then there was people who had been trained in economics, and they took one look at it and said, well, this is nonsense. Look, that doesn't make sense. So for, I mean, for one thing, it didn't have a concept of money. That's quite a difficult thing for the trained economist to get his head around. I just sort of proposed a model as if I proposed a model of human biology which doesn't have blood. And that blood is often, we talk about, well, we got to keep the money pumping around the economy. That shows this seems to me to be the cart before the horse. Could be another approach to how we organize our activity. Make sure everybody's well fed and well housed. And like, actually, those are the basic requirements more for human than columns balancing in ledgers and spreadsheets, which is the ultimate restriction. I'll make a long-term prediction that it's a difficult thing to explain, so I won't go into too much detail there. But the fundamental is that most people actually really like being kind, being thoughtful. We have this miracle called the conscience, and most people are quite familiar with it, and that's exactly why they need a lot of training. They have to be told that that's not a consideration, at least from 9 to 5, because there's huge international orthodoxy that says this is how life has to be. I'm optimistic because I think that alternative opinions are flowing pretty thick and fast compared to when there was no internet. I think people are really questioning what's going on in society. I mean, we haven't talked about some of the things that the deep state gets up to. They'll be familiar to a lot of unwelcome guest listeners.
But I think we are approaching the end of our time together, and I want for our listeners to be able to find out how to browse the back catalog of unwelcome guests. There's some tremendous material in there. How do they find it?
Okay, well, the website is unwelcomeguests.net. That's the plural. And there's a sidebar on the left. So if you want to do a keyword search on the title, so the episode index, you can also use the search box. But it's also organized by category. So if you click on a thing called Category Gallery, then you'll see there's about 750 episodes. Each one has an image and the categories too. You can go in a category. We got a category on deep politics. So there's a couple of dozen shows, I think, explaining that. There's subcategories as well. That's where you can get the Unwelcome Guests material.
Well, that, I think, is the education we need for the coming world. And from Bangladesh, we've been talking to broadcaster, math whiz, and social voice Robin Upton. And I'm going to put some helpful links in my show blog at ecoshock.org for you to follow up. And by all means, travel to Robin's own website at robinupton.com. Thank you so much, Robin. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Anyone can see signs of climate change. Ice is retreating. Each year is the new hottest record. The weather seems unstable. Plus, we have a constant stream of new science from all over the world confirming it. If the situation is becoming clearer, why are some scientists and top scientists still cautious? We'll find out with our next guest, a veteran organizer of scientific research. In 2007, Dr. David Carlson helped put together the International Polar Year. He has directed explorations into the ways oceans and the atmosphere interact. David led the Atmospheric Technology Branch of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, in the United States. Now Carlson is the director of the World Climate Research Program, or WCRP. From Geneva, David Carlson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be with you.
You know, there's a rush now to break climate predictions down into regional models and even to quantify the role of climate change in particular events like superfires or storms. You have a different direction and maybe a worry about all this?
I understand that regional focus, and there's also a lot of very good, very challenging science around the attribution issue that you mentioned. How much does an individual event represent natural variability, or how much does it have a climate footprint or a climate push on it? But I think a larger group of scientists, and especially in the World Climate Research Program, try to look at the larger patterns behind that, what forced that particular event or what set up that region for flood or drought. And in doing that, we rely on past experience quite a lot because we can't run multiple planet experiments at one time. And I think there's a sense that those larger patterns are changing. And the question then is, why are they changing? And what does that do to our predictive skill?
Well, I want to get into that deeper for sure as we get going here. I want to bring up one issue first, though. One of Canada's brightest climate scientists is Dr. Andrew Weaver from the University of Victoria, except he quit to become the first Green Member of Parliament here in British Columbia. Now, on Radio EcoShock, Andrew Weaver questioned whether we need any more climate science. He says, we know more than enough to know that we're in deep trouble. It's time for action. David, what do you think? Do we need a lot more climate science?
That's a very interesting question. I think both answers are correct. We do know absolutely enough to change our energy systems, to change our carbon emissions, et cetera. But then the interesting question, and you can take this from a national point of view, is how much do we need to change? How can we expect those changes to influence our coastline or our agricultural systems? How long do we have to make those changes? What options? How severe? So, yes, we know absolutely enough to get started, but I think we don't actually know enough to figure out our destination. So it's sort of like a trip. Yeah, let's get in, let's get going. Absolutely. I'm completely on that voyage. But where are we going to go? How are we going to get there? What's it going to look like when we get there? I think those are the questions of climate science.
Well, right. In an email, you told me that patterns are not what was expected. What did you mean?
Yeah, we watch the planet, and one of the things that we try to tease out are the various oscillations. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's high pressure, sometimes it's low pressure. And some of these have predictability or patterns that we can detect. And one of these has been the ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation System, where warm water, winds, storminess move back and forth across the Pacific. And I think we had gotten, I would say, reasonable skill at predicting some of these. And that gives us confidence that we understand the system. If we say, okay, this year will be a warm event or a cold event in the ENSO warm-cold cycle, and therefore we'll get around the tropics, we'll get more rain here, or we'll get drought here. You know, that gives us a little bit of confidence. And that's important in our interactions with, as we said a moment ago, with regions, because then we can give them some predictions with confidence for agriculture, et cetera. But those patterns have sort of fallen apart. And if we look at ENSO, if you look in the textbooks, it's described as an every 5 to 7 year sort of warm event and then oscillation with a cold event in between, something like that. And 82, 83, 87, 88, 92, 93, 98. It was sort of regular. And then we had this gap from 98 until 2014. So we went, what, 15, 17 years without a big warm event. So the first thing we say is, well, why did that happen? Then if you watch what we did, we had a rather strong prediction of 2014 as a warm event. NOAA had it, the Bureau of Meteorology had it. It looked like really a good forecast, and then that warm event never showed up. After that, we went back again, and 2015 was actually a valid forecast in that case. We got a pretty good warm event, but its impact, for example, on the North American West Coast, the Eastern Pacific regions, like breaking the California drought or impacts on Peru, Chile, didn't happen the way we thought. That if you watch the predictions that people were saying, finally we'll break the California drought, but 2015 didn't do that. Now we're in 2016, or we just finished 2016, where we had sort of the cold event, and you would say that's not normally a wet year along the U.S. West Coast, but of course, California just got dumped with a very healing snow, winter snow accumulation. If you watch what's going on in Peru at the moment, it looks like a classic warm event. So these patterns that had some predictability, they were never perfect. And, you know, one warm event was never a perfect mirror of the previous one. But these patterns, which had some predictability, have sort of broken down, at least recently. And there's this new player on the block, which we call the Arctic. And science is quite divided right now about how much is the tropics impacting global and how much is the Arctic impacting global. And it's sort of like tropics, equatorial and tropics pushing on the mid-latitudes and Arctic polar pushing on the mid-latitudes from the polar end. And then the mid-latitudes where most of us live and where these weather patterns evolve seems to be influenced from both directions. And that requires us to sort of rethink our models and rethink our basic understanding.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, when I was first gathering climate news and reports in the 1990s, the rule was simple. The tropics determine the weather in the mid-latitudes where many of my listeners live. And now we've had Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers as our guest twice, and her observation is that the meltback of Arctic sea ice and lower snow cover on land has coincided, at least, with a jet stream that is slower and is bent, and that can shape significant weather events. What's your assessment on that discussion?
Yeah, she stimulated that, absolutely. And the initial reaction was, no, not possible, you know, can't happen. But there's a dozen studies, mostly from the observational record. If you look carefully, you can see exactly these patterns. Maybe they're in some regions, in some seasons, northern hemisphere winter, for example. But you can start to tease out these correlations from the observational records. The tricky bit at the moment, and science is trying to address this, is that the climate models, I was going to say for the most part, I would say many climate models don't reproduce that. Some climate models do, and if you force them in a certain way, sometimes you can get these patterns. So it's an interesting question for us as a climate research community. If one of our tools is telling us one thing, giving us this signal of an Arctic pushback on mid-latitude circulation, and we're not able to confirm that or reproduce that in our models, then I think it's inherent in us, and that's exactly the way the science is going, is to say, okay, what's going on here? And one of the approaches is to say, well, instead of doing this sort of as a sideline, meaning we take a model that's developed for global and we look to see if we see an Arctic, what if we focus the models on exactly this question and compared what Canadian model shows or what NCAR model shows or what the UK model shows and start to make a focus on it? And I think that's exactly the stage that we're at, because we've got this inconsistency where you can see it in the observations if you're careful, and Jennifer and her group really set that off. But it's not possible in many of the models right now to actually pull the physics together and reproduce it. So we're sort of, one of our tools shows a good signal, the observations, but the model's not yet. And I think that's exactly the situation we're in at the moment.
Well, all right, I'll throw a little gas on the model fire when I say that a recent guest has published a paper saying these biophysical climate models fail to include enough influence from humans and from this civilization. And that's Safa Modashari from the University of Maryland. He told us things like population and consumption can really change the environment that we're trying to model, but the biggest climate models have no dynamic inputs for those sorts of things or for the economy. Dave, is that fair? And can we include human drivers now in the Anthropocene?
Well, we have to distinguish between the physical climate models and then the impact and assessment models. We have a sort of a rule of thumb in climate modeling that we call no miracles, meaning we can't imagine some future carbon sink or a carbon removal process that will magically take carbon out. So we have to live with that. The climate models are in the stage where they evolve from purely a physical model to what we call an Earth system model, which would fit what you called, Alex, a biogeochemical model, meaning that carbon actually, you know, plants actually grow, carbon actually goes into the ocean. You actually get an interactive carbon cycle rather than prescribing the carbon cycle. Do they have perfect resolution over urban areas or over tropical forests or any? They don't, because we can add all these features of the models, but we can't at the same time also get them to run 10 kilometer globally. So, we're limited by what our tools are. But my pushback on that comment is that the models are, on the physics, they're actually quite good. And when you are confronted with a challenge like this Arctic feedback, this Arctic influence problem, probably there's a lot to be learned by looking at those models. Why do some models and some, under some forcings, reproduce this effect? Why do others not? Is the weakness in how they treat the Arctic? Is the weakness in how they move heat and energy from the tropics towards the poles? So we can use the disparity among models as a sort of a diagnostic. And out of that, we'll both understand the system better, but also get better models.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm here with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program. I'm a bit nervous that the public is trying to nail down a fixed image of climate change these days. For example, we have several record hot years in a row, likely with Pacific Ocean temperatures as a driver. But what happens if we have three really cold years? Is that still possible?
It's absolutely possible. I don't think we can continue to set records every year, but the forcing function will be carbon. And so if we continue to put CO2 in, and we put a lot of CO2 in both 2015 and 2016, then we're going to get warm years. Is it always going to be a record warm month? We just did record warm February, NASA announced. No, it's not always going to be a record warm. We will not get, I think it would be unlikely for us to see a deep cooling. We're certainly not going to go for record cooling, but we're not going to set a record warm year or a record warm month every month and every year. But that's a little bit misleading, because generally what we're looking at when we look at those records are something easy, relatively easy to measure, like surface air temperature, global surface air temperature. And what we really need to be looking at is where the energy is going, and that's in the interior ocean. And there, to the best ability of our observations, the heating in the interior ocean has been pretty much relentless. So we might get a cool year, or we might get a relatively cool year in the northern hemisphere, or we might get a relatively cool year over Europe, etc. But that's sort of like the small hair on the long tail of a big dog, and the big dog is the ocean, and that's where we really need to be looking.
Right. A week ago, friends in the East complained to me they were out in shirt sleeves in the afternoon and then snowed into a deep freeze later the same day. You might have been there then. I don't know. But it's not new in March. But, you know, after we get summer weather in December in North America and then hail in July, the public has begun to distrust the weather. Are we becoming too paranoid too soon, or is it the beginnings of climate change?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question. If you look at our seasonal prediction for North America, we forecast this warm west, cold east pattern that we had in a recent year, for example. And that didn't really happen this year. And now we have to go back and figure out why. But that does not preclude cold, snowy events. I was just in Montreal, and they got a lot of snow. That does not preclude single cold, snowy events. And I don't think we can take any individual event and assign it as a harbinger of warmer or a harbinger of colder. We have to look at these big patterns. But exactly as you say, Alex, nothing's going to prevent us from getting a deep snow in Montreal or the U.S. Atlantic coast in springtime. And that's, if you look at the weather records, that's one that many of the big snows have happened in the past.
And you wrote to me, ecosystems prior to collapse very often show clear signs of unpredictability. What does that look like? Do you have an example handy?
Yeah, there's several examples. And this is interesting, this question of how does a system become predictable or become less predictable. It's definitely an issue in weather forecasting, and it's a sort of a complex system question. But some of the interesting examples have to do with ecosystems where you have a grazer, it's in balance with its food resource, maybe it's in balance with predators, maybe it's got diseases or parasites, you know, so the system sort of, you get population oscillations, you get good years and then a couple low years and a good year, but when those ecosystems are relatively well in balance, the ecosystem itself functions in this sort of regular pattern, and they become reasonably predictable if you know how much food resource there has been in a given ecosystem. This year, you can predict what the grazers are going to do, and you can probably predict what the predators are going to do. And there's quite a lot of literature on this, especially on terrestrial ecosystems. But one of the things that happens, and unfortunately they have in that science several quite good examples, is when that ecosystem is stressed by changes in the resource base, for example, or changes in the predation pressure, they tend to go into large oscillations. So you get a very large population followed by a very low population collapse, and it might go through that a couple cycles, and then they get collapsed. It's, how would you say, it's reliable enough, or it's diagnostic enough, so they can watch these amplitudes of these population oscillations and say, whoa, that one's looking sort of wild. We might be close to collapse or something like that. And that's a lot of what in the biodiversity community you see as them building their predictive skill around this change from a regular predictable oscillation to a much wilder, unpredictable, and that lack of predictability then becomes an indicator of imminent collapse of that ecosystem. So it's not a perfect analogy, but it gets us on this issue of what features of a system, complex system, allow it to have predictability, higher predictability at one time and lower predictability at another. And what does that tell us about the external stresses on the system?
What is the World Climate Research Program, or the WCRP, that you direct?
It's mostly a small coordination program for the big world of climate science. Many of our most important activities have to do with the comparison of the climate models. So we do the set the standards, we share the forcing data, we set up the infrastructure so that if you're at Beijing Center or if you're at a Canadian Climate Center or GFDL or UK, then you can share your climate data with other research around the world, and that sharing, that so-called CMIP, Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, then becomes the basis for the IPCC assessments and the UNFCCC policy negotiations. So we don't actually run any of the climate models. We don't actually fund any of those, but we sort of set up the sharing infrastructure, if you will, so that the people running those models can actually share their data and do the intercomparison. And we do a similar thing on the observation side. We share the data on carbon, we share the data on precipitation, et cetera. So we're sort of a coordination body that adds international cooperation and international value on top of these many very strong climate research programs.
Well, that sounds important to me. We do have to be able to talk to one another. And, you know, when I picture how climate research is working, I do see a lot of computing power, and I also see some very experienced scientific researchers that are kind of working together. I wonder if we're going to come to the point, though, where artificial intelligence will be churning away on masses of data much greater than you or I could ever handle, and come up with something and say, hey, by the way, humans, when the nitrogen cycle changes, so does the rainfall, or something that we hadn't expected.
Definitely. In the size of data sets, both satellite data sets, ground-based in-situ data sets, ocean data sets, and the climate model outputs, we will use these data mining techniques. I don't think, at least in the short term, that it's going to be a sort of a random search around and artificial intelligence comes up with something, because these are careful, complicated human products, and it's not like something, you know, you can send a data mining little robot or whatever they're called out to sort of graze around and find something. The climate modelers have been very careful about how these things are constructed, so I don't think there's a big surprise in there. I do think that because we're producing so much of these data, especially from satellites and from climate model outputs, that using these automated tools to visualize some of these things, and I'm not saying there wouldn't be discoveries or even surprises, but I don't think we're going to get a fundamental reset of our understanding of the climate system just because we put so much work into trying to get these models to work in the first place that I doubt that we're going to, you know, that machines are going to give us any kind of radical change in the way we understand climate.
All right, now, who determines what the priority global research questions are?
Well, the researchers do this because they have to write their proposals. They have to get them funded. They have to compete for computing resources. And good, that it should actually be that kind of bottom-up energy ideas, explore the difficult, challenging problems. But every one of them, in climate at least, realizes that they can't do it alone individually, and they probably can't do it alone in their institution, so that the Canadian climate modelers need to understand what the Australians are seeing and how their model output compares with what the UK does, etc. So, yes, the energy and ideas grow bottom up, but in order to have a collective voice, in order to also do the kind of comparisons that allows us to both improve at the national level, but also improve at the international level, then we need these coordinated activities.
Should we be optimistic about what we can still learn from continuing climate research? David Carlson, what do we hope the payoff could be?
Well, right now I think there's probably three questions. Let's assume that we get a good buy-in to a Paris Agreement. Let's assume that we start to get control over the carbon emissions. I think there's three questions. One is, where is the carbon going to go, which is not a question about how much are we going to emit or how much goes in the atmosphere, but it's really a question of how strong is the sink in the ocean and how strong is the sink on land? The second question is, how is the weather going to change with the climate, which touches exactly on several of the issues that we talked about, Alex, which is, how do these extreme events in frequency or duration or timing change as the climate changes? And the third one is a little bit broader question, but I think it's challenging, which is, how will climate change the habitability of the planet and its region? So it gets back to this regional question. And there we're thinking about things like sea level. That's a habitability question for all the coasts around the world. Again, back to these extremes, you know, long-term drought, long-term flood, long-term precipitation changes, large-scale changes in the circulation in the jet stream that we've talked about in this show. So it's a little more elaborate than just how will the climate change, but how will the climate change the habitability of our planet? And I think those three questions, where does the carbon go, how does the weather change with climate, and how does climate change the habitability? I think those are exactly the right questions that we need to know, whether countries are meeting their carbon targets or not. That's the kind of information that we need.
Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or tell our listeners?
I think this whole enterprise of climate modeling is one of the remarkable human activities. A climate model is a couple million lines of code. It's trying to represent in physics, in biogeochemistry, in a consistent numerical form, how the system works. How do leaves respond to sunlight? How does cloud processes produce precipitation? How does freshwater run off into the ocean? How does ocean mixing happen in the straits and over the topography of the bottom? It's a really audacious enterprise to say, oh, yeah, I think we could actually put all that in a model. And I think that the fact that humans are trying to do it, that, you know, roughly 20 modeling centers around the world are putting a lot of people on this problem, I think that's a really quite a remarkable resource, that their work tends to be disparaged from outside. It's easy to disparage it from outside, but the creativity and the innovation that's going into this task is one of the planet's human resources, and I think we're well set. I mean, that's exactly what humans should be doing. It's not automatic, you know, that it would succeed. So I think that's one of the really audacious tasks that climate research has put itself, and I really like the fact that the researchers have tried to do that.
These are the tools that Aristotle would have loved to have had.
It would be fun to try and explain to Aristotle and his concept of the phases, how that gets mapped out at 25-kilometer resolution in 47 layers in the atmosphere around the world. That would be a very interesting conversation.
It would be. We've been talking with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program in Geneva. You can find out more information with some links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Alex, it was fun. I'm glad to support what you're doing.
We're out of time again. Thank you for listening. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
The economy comes first.
Workers have families to support.
If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't
sell it, that's all carbon crackhead talk.
Be realistic.
The transition will take years.
But they don't seem to be putting any real effort or money into the one really great emergency and threat that is coming. We have a cooked world. We are on our way towards a biologically dead planet.
In the blink of a lifetime, the whirlwind will sweep it all away.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot, flinders, spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?